Welcome to Waking Up Is Not Enough, Flourishing in the Human Space. Whether you awaken through meditation, spiritual practice, near-death experience, ingesting a mind-altering substance, or being born again, you still return to your messy life without any special instructions. In this podcast, Polly Young-Eisendrath and Michael Berger talk with scientists, spiritual teachers, and other experts about how awakening can connect to a new path for flourishing and development on which waking up is important, but not enough, and growing up is never finished. Polly and Mike bring different kinds of expertise to the conversation. Polly is a psychologist, Jungian analyst, mindfulness teacher, author, and longtime practitioner of Zen Buddhism, as well as the founder and director of the Center for Real Dialogue. Mike is an expert in psychedelics, an entrepreneur, a skeptic, a practitioner of Jewishness, a documentary filmmaker, and a Real Dialogue specialist. The Center for Real Dialogue produces and edits this podcast entirely through donations. We want to keep it available for free to our listeners. Our unique perspective needs to be supported by people like you. Please make a donation on our GoFundMe platform, introduce our podcast to family and friends, and support us on social media. We genuinely need the support of all of our entire community, and we're grateful for it.
Human consciousness is self-consciousness. A conversation with an authority on human consciousness, Dr. Michael Lewis. You may be confused about the word consciousness because it is used broadly to mean anything that has awareness of any kind, from a fungus to a dolphin to a human being. Unfortunately, this has been the way we speak with each other about consciousness since Darwin came onto the scene. Consequently, as humans, we do not know what our unique features of consciousness are, nor how they are related to our emotional development and our lives. You may know the word ego, but you probably do not know how it relates to your self-conscious emotions, like shame or guilt, or even that you have self-conscious emotions. In this podcast, you will find out precisely the meaning of how humans are conscious, because you will hear a conversation with Dr. Michael Lewis, an expert on human consciousness. The psychologist Dr. Michael Lewis from Rutgers University is famous for providing the exact test and the precise investigation of the birth of self-consciousness in humans. We are the only organism here on Earth that is aware of its awareness in such a way that we abstract and theorize our own identities. Then, of course, we fight about them also and get polarized. In this conversation, Dr. Lewis talks with Polly and Mike about the beginnings and the developments of human consciousness. Dr. Lewis is the foremost researcher on self-consciousness and self-conscious emotions in the United States, having spent 65 years investigating them in his laboratory at Rutgers University. Michael Lewis, PhD, is University Distinguished Professor of Pediatrics and Psychiatry and Director of the Institute for the Study of Child Development at the Rutgers University Robert Wood Johnson Medical College. He is also Professor of Psychology, Education, and Biomedical Engineering at Rutgers. Dr. Lewis is a fellow of the New York Academy of Sciences, the American Psychological Association, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science. He's one of the most prominent social scientists in the United States and is a recipient of the Yuri Bronfenbrenner Award for Lifetime Contribution to Developmental Psychology from the American Psychological Association, and the Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award in Child Development from the Society for Research in Child Development.
And I am very clear with the people I know and love to simply say, you can't tell me you can't. You can't say you're a failure. You have to just keep trying. and see what it leads to. It's not going to hurt you, and so on. And with care for another, and with some connection, you can succeed. But it's very hard to get people not to be ashamed. It's the same problem in ego. We have a perfect example. We keep electing a president, which is fantastic, given that the whole culture has now become narcissistic and full of shame and self, overstating of the self. Very typical of what hubris is all about. And the fact is, it's all around us, and you can affect it culturally. And this culture is, I can go next to a neighbor in a restaurant, and I'm talking softly to my wife and my friends, and they are shouting at each other and laughing out loud. And I'll go over and I say, "Could you please talk a little softer?" Now I say, "I'm old, I'm a little deaf, and I can't hear my lovely wife, and I'll get into all kinds of trouble if I don't hear her. So could you lower your voice?" I used to say, "You're talking too loud, and you'll excuse my language." They would say, "Go fuck yourself." That's the standard. It's a free country. I can do whatever I want. That is the narcissist speaking in a cultural-wide situation. And how did we prove it?
Are you suggesting, and I'm not sure again how much we want to go into this, but that shame and humiliation are at the root of narcissism typically, and also that the issue, here's the way I would say it also, that in developing the self, if the individual is in an environment in which there is a focus, and it may be completely unconscious and unintentional, but a focus on perfecting something rather than learning from mistakes. You know, the guilt is built on the idea that you can repair things because you've made mistakes and mistakes are reparable. But shame is built on the idea that somehow you're bad if you can't perfect, that there's something wrong with you if you got it wrong, rather than, you know, it was a mistake. So even the idea of a mistake essentially is an idea that promotes guilt rather than shame. You made a mistake. You can correct a mistake. You're not bad. You know, you're bad if you make mistakes and you should have perfected it. So that there is a way of saying that narcissism or the focus on the idea of the self, you know, the focus on I should be free to do it the way I want to do it, is the result of not understanding really mistakes, you know, not understanding how mistakes are made, that they're made really out of, you know, not intention to do something wrong, but because we're full of wrongness as humans. We make mistakes all the time, you know, and we can repair because we can say, I'm sorry. And I understand. And yet, there's a lot of confusion in parents, you know, also in educators. Lots of people confuse the issue of, you know, this is a mistake, you can repair it with you're bad or yourself, you're off, you're wrong, there's something wrong with you because you've made the mistake. So, you know, again, I don't want to get too far into this.
I want to take you back
Yeah.
to Buddhism,
Yes.
believe it or
Okay.
not,
We go there a lot here. Yes.
because I have written a paper, just essentially, it was published, but it was essentially the outline. I'm going to give you another one. I'm going to suggest that we have forgotten the first step as one moves toward enlightenment, if you will, which is that bad things happen. And now parenting has radically changed, and it's changed over my lifetime, if you live long enough, and we lived in a period. It has gone from being taught rules to being taught that I love you no matter what. Okay? That has been the most destructive feature. And the title of the paper is The Death of Etiquette. It is fundamentally our entire parenting got off on the wrong track, And people know how I feel about attachment theory, as proposed by Bowlby and Ainsworth and a continued crew of clinicians who really don't know very much of what they really said. But the point is that, in fact, when, I'll tell it to you, you can cut it out or keep it or whatever you want. We did a whole set of studies on lying, on children lying. And it's very simple. I mean, we develop the paradigm. Kid sits like I'm sitting behind the kid. There's a big box. It's full of a toy. And we promise the kid we're going to play with that toy, but they're not to look, okay? And then the experimenter says, I have to go out of the room for a little while. Remember, don't look at it. We'll play with it when I come back. Of course, we have cameras hidden everywhere, and we look. And it turns out that by 2.5, only 33% tell the truth. 60% either don't answer it or lie. Okay, so they lie. So we let the mothers, who usually bring the kids, sit in and watch when I'm watching this going on. And they say, oh, I never believed my kid lied. Okay, and they are shocked by it. So I started to collect stories, okay? And a story goes like this. Susie, the child, goes to a friend's house and brings home a toy of the child that she played with. And she says to Susie, the mother, how did you get that toy? She said, they gave it to me. Okay, so it's a nice toy. She calls up her friend's mother and says, you know, she came home with, if she took it by mistake, you know, I'll bring it back the next time I see it. And she took it, as it turns out, was not given it. And so the mom turns and says to the child, you lied to me. You lied to me. She talks about the failure in the relationship when indeed she should be talking about the moral essential. Namely, you can't take something that doesn't belong to you. Lying to her is a stronger moral failure in some sense. And that's what parenting has gone to. Rather than looking at, this is what you do. When you get a present, you thank people. Even if you don't like it, etiquette requires you behave. You take, go to a dinner party, and the food is terrible and the company worse. And on your way out, or writing a note, what you're supposed to do for social cohesiveness, very important, you're supposed to say, I enjoyed it, thank you for inviting me, and so on. You're not supposed to let it all hang out, tell the truth. Food was awful, the company was worse, I will never go to your house again, is what I'm feeling, but it's not what I'm saying. And the idea that we are not capable of moving toward a moral principled world, but in fact apologizing for the fact that in the world is imperfect and things happen and there's no, and it shouldn't be blame. It should be a corrective process and not blame. But we haven't learned that. That's what the paper's about. And by the way, there's ample evidence to say the narcissism in the last 25 years has grown enormously among college age students and so on. So the fact of the matter is, I see much of the blame, not for highly critical, quite to the opposite, overpraise. Because overpraise is, if you don't praise, it's of course, then it's really bad. And if you do praise, you're not teaching anything. So there are, I think, deep cultural, structural conditions which impact on these processes, which we, you guys, in a therapeutic sense, are trying to tackle and deal with. I'm trying to understand, where did it go? You know, you're in a crowd and someone smashes into you. No, I'm an old man and I'm a little old man, and someone smashed into me, they knock me. And they don't say, I'm sorry. They often say, look where you're going. Oh, well, you bumped into me, whatever. All you have to do is say you're sorry. You don't have to be sorry. You don't have to send me a bouquet of flowers. You have to say it. You have to do it to one another. And this narcissism is, in fact, what and feeds the shame, because you can't be wrong because you're ashamed. That's the worst thing you can do to yourself. So that fundamentally, what we need to do is to move toward rules of behavior, not whether you're good or bad. And that's not what our parenting is any longer doing. And, right. And the paper talks about that it's no longer the first principle, which is bad things happen. It happens, okay. How do we prevent it from happening? What do we do? You're not the only person who knocked over a vase in the world that another person liked. You're not a bad person. That's the lesson. Mm-hmm. And from that is an avoidance of narcissism. Why I love you anyway.
We've covered a bit of ground. A couple of different things. One, about the comment about the people at the next table telling you to go fuck yourself. Keep in mind, you're still in Manhattan, the center of narcissism. Between LA and Manhattan, there's a wide space where people would actually apologize still in the Midwest, which is where I am. So some of that's a little bit about, which I do think is connected to what I heard you say about how the self develops. If you, at least there are places, it still seems to me, in the Midwest where people do have connection and community, and they do still have those rules and they still teach those rules. Everybody isn't exceptional. So that would be one place. The other, over and over again, I feel like we danced around the significance of the subjective interpretation and meaning making. So for people who I'm connected with, who have, that I've observed a deep sense of shame, one thing I've noticed is it's as if they have an irreparably damaged self that can't hear anything that contradicts what it has been ingrained to believe is an inherent defect in itself, and that in an ideal world, they would feel different, but they feel alienated from the ideal world since that world doesn't exist. You brought up these, mentioned some of the precepts of Buddhism about impersonal, imperfect, and impermanent. And I think there's part of this is I can make a connection as well with the way I've observed in younger generations this sense of having only been given positive feedback. That there's no, everybody is exceptional. Everybody gets a gold star. So you have an equalized outcome instead of equal opportunity. And I think this has played out in other larger policy issues, which all seem to culminate in creating generations of individuals, or I would call them self-centered selves. They do not necessarily grow up, which is one of the things, one of the main themes that we come back to, is about how waking up isn't enough, and that, you know, growing up takes a lifetime. So it's as if that generationally, there's something stunted in the growth of their own ability to develop beyond self-centered, to get even to, in some cases, you know, using Levinger's terms, conscientious conformism, or beyond that. It seems that, and I'm going to try to connect this with something else you said, or I heard you say, which had to do with the mean response has no meaning. So it's, to me, there's a connection now that's the mean, the way the people basically would respond to you in Manhattan at the table saying, go fuck yourself. That's the mean response. So now the question is, where are the outliers now? If that's the mean, if narcissism is the mean, what does that say about finding meaning? So much of what I'm hearing in the development of self is using language, which is inherited from our culture, our family of origin, our geography, and the randomness of the time we're born into. So much of that seems to be part of an aspect of taking on language. And I'm not sure I can bring it all together, but the other part is the measures that you used were all projective tests. So there's a dynamic or a play here between you use developing an inside and an outside, which corresponds with the self-referential I or me-ness, but then that can go to an extreme where it's all about me and mine to become this narcissistic collective or cohort. So, you know, and then from a Buddhist perspective, one would say there isn't even a self. So there's a paradox to this developmental track of creating a self to eventually get to a point where myself is part of something greater. It's not separate from, it's not more important than. And I guess culturally,
I'm going to jump in for a moment. Yeah. Try to bring back the idea of rules, etiquette, things that are taught, that in this period of time and the way parents look at those, they're often connected to what people would call organized religion. And there's been a rejection of organized religion and tradition. So these rules that are taught, we could call them ethical or moral, or we could simply call them rules of conduct, you know, for etiquette. Those rules in every other period of time until the very recent late 20th century to the beginning of the 21st century were considered to be a part of Western culture, at least, you know, maybe not all cultures, well, also Asia, definitely, that those rules are required, I believe, for self-referential behavior to work in a social context. In other words, before we can learn how to break the rules, we have to learn the rules. And that's what I believe in places like perhaps, you know, on the East Coast and the West Coast, but not St. Louis, you know, the rules dropped away. People became very focused on feeling good, you know, wanting their kids to feel good, and misunderstood the meaning of the rules. I want to just go back for a moment to Piaget's work on the moral judgment of the child, because it has to do with lying, as, you know, Michael brought that up. So Piaget's idea is that originally that young child does lie if the child is smart, you know, just like Donald Trump said he would break the rules and not pay the taxes because he's smart. But that's a very early development. That's early. You're smart, you break the rules, you lie. You did, you know, you don't do what you told the researcher you were going to do. You take the toy or you look at the toys. But over time, what Piaget found is that kids learn the real meaning of lying by playing with their equals, doing team sports or playing games with other kids. You begin to recognize that lying is not about saying words. It's about breaking trust. It's about breaking up the social cohesion of the group so that your team can't play if you lie to your team. They can't play together. They're, you know, he said basically it's not until a kid is 11 to 12 years old that they can really even begin to understand what a lie is, because it's complex. You know, you move from it being an advantage you're taking for yourself to the idea that you're just getting away with things and it's a matter of words, you're not really hurting anybody. It's not, you know, sticks and stones that break your bones, words don't really hurt people. You move through that to recognizing, wait a minute, if I don't tell my team the truth, we don't have any trust, we can't work together, to, oh my gosh, if I lie, I don't know, you know, how I can even trust in the group because I'm not sure what I told this person and that person. So the idea of the rules and the laws have to do with setting the standards in the beginning. So the child has to learn this is the way it's done. And then you gradually experiment with that. I mean, Piaget says, again, in that early development, the kids don't understand it because the parents say, don't lie. They teach that as a rule, but the parents don't understand the complexity of it. I guess what I'm trying to say here is that rules and laws, and particularly traditions, seem to me to have dropped away in a very dangerous way, and that they can't be substituted for by everybody loving everybody, because that doesn't work. You know, it's the human self is actually not good at knowing itself. You know, we have the experience of being a self.
Both of you have stressed, and I think rightly so, the social embeddedness. And I think that would explain, would help us understand more than we do. I actually did a book on lying and deception in everyday life. And I've come to a slightly different conclusion, which I won't get into because it's sort of, I disagree with that. I believe lying is important, but I believe what is important is social cohesion, that we are succeeded as a species because we could form large cohesive groups which aided us in hunting, aided us in times of difficulty. But there's also a development of the individual. And I think we've gotten those mixed up a bit. I think that the very act of there's a me and there's a you forces into or should a cohesive social network because there isn't just me, but there is a me, there is a you. And if we're not going to change that because I really believe from a strong biological point of view and our work on the brain, God help me for saying this, we've done some studies, in fact, shows areas which mature around the time when we think this idea of of myself is established. It does have possession qualities. This is mine. This is yours. I know it's mine because for whatever reasons and so on. So there are forces at work for cohesiveness. Historically, and I've read extensively, I wanted to try to find out when did people start changing in care of children books of how you should treat children and breaking their spirit. Punishment were very, very strong ideas to establish cohesiveness. Those were the rules that were done. And the rules have changed, and probably for the better, because if you read historically, Susan Miller has a book or several books on the history of parenting, which are very interesting to read about. So I think what has happened is that, as always, an evolution of the individual that changes. And what has changed is our relationship to the other group. There is a cohesiveness. And as Mike points out, I think not unreasonable to say there are regional differences. I suspect less regional differences that the Midwest would like to think it's only the evil East Coast, the coasts, who have this problem. I suspect not. I mean, just looking at how people vote, one would get some idea. But I think cohesiveness of the group has in large part been sacrificed for things like honesty. Why should I not tell you? Why don't I have a right to tell you that it's a lousy meal and that, you put too much salt in and you shouldn't do it next time? And maybe if you get better at it, I would love to come again. Well, that's the truth. No one in the Midwest is going to do that. No one anywhere is going to do that because of issues of social cohesiveness. The point being that I think there's a developmental, it may be an evolution. I can't do that. It's quite clear that the great apes have a self. There is just no question about it. And there are people, very smart people, many of them who have died recently, who believe that animals had, and that the puppy dog raising the lion forms a bond of some sort, and they remain friends, and the lion doesn't eat the cat. Who knows what we're going to do with that or have to do with it? But the point is, in humans and human-like, there clearly is, by the time of the great apes, everything that tells us. Now, are monkeys? No, monkeys don't do it. Do elephants do it? There are some reports elephants have it. We don't know where it's been extended to in the animal kingdom. But the counter to that, a counter to there's a me and there's a you, and I like that and you have that, is cohesiveness, is sharing, is a culture in which we take care of one another, which we teach our kids. No, you can't shoot through the door and kill somebody on the other side of the door because they're of a different color. That's not a thing we should be doing. Not because we're allowed to have guns, but there's no cohesiveness. So I think our problem is on what level we start to want to work on it. Okay? Now, we can't work on a group in a therapeutic situation. We are attending to work on individual for the most part. The point is that it's multiple level. And if you ask me, what did I learn by becoming 88? Is that nothing is simple, and it's all approximation. And the best thing I can tell you is there's an approximation of individual differences in the developmental pattern. Not a good idea of what causes it. There are likely to be temperament factors, which are biological in nature and not taught by parenting. And there's certainly parenting. And we've looked at both, and they both seem to be involved. More complex story that you and I are going to, in an hour or whatever, solve, and I in my lifetime. But I am sure of certain elements.
Michael, just let me ask you one thing before you know, this is the one thing that I, you know, you could say, yes, elephants and maybe giraffes and higher apes and so on have a formation of a self, and there's indications they do. But the level of abstraction that humans have, where we abstract our identity, we theorize it, we theorize other people's identities, we attribute intentionality to others that's actually wrong. We're way beyond other animals in terms of the ways that we use the sense that somehow I am an individual and I know who that individual is. And I do think it enters into social cohesion, because I know you've spent a long time studying in Japan. I've been in Japan quite a lot. The sense of self in Japan is quite different than in the U.S., and there are different self-conscious, let's say, behaviors, you know, particularly involving shame and pride, et cetera. And I've talked about this. You've talked about this. I think that the way that humans theorize the self does, and it is abstract, the way we theorize it, that we could make changes in our social rules simply by recognizing the deep interdependence of the self and the importance that individual self-formation is affected by the ways that parents raise their children, whether they get those rules from the church or the synagogue, or whether they get those rules from a developmental psychologist, or whether they get them from whatever the source is, that if in, you know, North America, we imagine that we do have to form our children in such a way that they could be liked by others and that they could go on developing in a community, I think we could change our parenting. You know, it's like there is a theory of self, and humans do theorize it. Yeah.
I think what you've said is makes sense. And I think when one has a liberty, as I do, because I'm not treating people, I'm not helping in that way, to worry about some issues. As for who has what, we have to be very careful of our language, because when we say that the child knows its mother, that's our language, not the child. The child doesn't have its mother in its head. It may have familiar people, okay? So all of the research, everything being done, is imparts to that child a very elaborate ideas where some of it may not be, okay? All, if you watch people with animals, all they need to do is feed it, hold it, touch it, caress it, and they make friends of these animals in a parent-child-like fashion, okay? And so it's come to, people who study infant-mother interactions, it's come to that there are two individuals in there essentially learning about each other, and they're learning in the same way, and they're not at all. There's one with a self and one without a self, but you can do behaviors which impart meaning, which you then, once you have language, once you have a self, you can, in fact, talk about it. That person cares for me. That person loves me. I don't have to do it. It's the one with the long trunk and the chip down the ear. It's I can describe it in a better way. But I guess what I'm saying is, if I, well, I'm still licensed as a psychotherapist, I'm not going to do it. I would get groups of people, young people, And I would get them to talk about their feelings about group, feelings about individuals, themselves in particular, and to talk about how those interface with group. One of the first things is you got to have rules. You have to have rules because it turns out you cannot have maximum freedom. I mean, I love it when people divorce because they feel I'm too connected to that other person. I have to do half the time I have to go to the movies that they like to go to. And I want to go always to the movie I want to go to. Not understanding that if you're by yourself, you can do it, but it's less fun than going with someone. So there are rules that seem to pay off. I don't know what they are. And I think they may differ in Chicago than in New York. Brooklyn may be even different than both of them, where I grew up. But the fact of the matter is that we know that to make it better, that we have to work in both places. We have to work in group cohesion. And there are ways of doing that. And that needs to be done. And it can't be done in individual therapy only. It's just not going to work. Why not? Here, three smart people here in this room together. Why don't we write an etiquette book for the 21st century? Let's give examples. You get a gift, and you, Christmas time, Hanukkah, whatever particular holiday you're celebrating, someone sends you something. Someone sends me chocolate-covered strawberries. My daughter, all the time. And I keep saying, listen, I don't want chocolate. I don't like chocolate-covered strawberries. I know it's an easy thing, and I know it's an expression of you care, and so on. You know what? What I care about? Send me the receipt that you gave to for this organization that helps people. That strawberries I don't want. Well, now I have to worry that she's a physician, and my first call of if I need help is that. She'd be happy that she knows that I care and so on. But I also know that I have a lesson, even though she's mid-50s, that gifts to individuals are good, but we have to discuss it. What would you like as a gift? Not what I call up Joe and David or whatever the thing is, and they say a thing of strawberries and it costs me X amount, and I'm done. Okay, yeah. So what I'm saying is that how we construct that, and I'm not the one for it now. I'm done. I have the philosophy chair, and I can say what I think need to be done. I mean, that's the one of the luxuries. By the way, you have to ask when people retire, are they satisfied with what they've done? Okay. And I know people who are still struggling with they got to write another paper and they got to do another thing and a book, and they keep urging me. And I'm saying, whatever I'm going to do now, I've done. And I'm very content and satisfied. I'm not number one in God, is referenced more than I am. So I'll live with that. So the point is that we need to think of it. We who are smart and capable and have the means to do it need to think about how we have to incorporate these kinds of social values. And I think in etiquette, I would love to sit down with a number of people and write out a whole series of life scripts about what we should do on this condition. What do we do in the condition that someone bumps into you and doesn't say, I apologize for doing it? Is there anything to be done? We could do it on a therapeutic sense. What do we do with a patient? How do we behave and so on? We do it with friends who are not in the field at all. And they come saying, well, this, and this. And you say, I better keep my mouth shut because I shouldn't say anything. I'm trying to get at this idea that there's an individual, there's a path of development of that individual, there are individual differences in it. And they're going to intersperse with a culture. We need larger model, not so large that we can't go down to look at the individual and look at the particular parenting they have. But people are totally untrustworthy. I mean, I'm not going to go into it. I did a study where we actually looked at When kids were a year old, their attachment in the classical case with their parents. And I followed them until they were 18. And I'll tell you one finding. It's related to nothing when they're 18. Not their mental health, not their parenting skills or anything else. It's unrelated. It's unrelated. Why? Because, and I wrote a book on the past doesn't predict the future. Fundamentally, we're a complex God Almighty that we evolved into this creature. We're in, you know, so that it's not simple. And it's not simple. And I don't know how much we can do in a therapeutic sense. My wife trained psychoanalysts, so I'm not talking like I hate all analysts at all. Quite to the contrary. So, but the point is that I don't know. Should you go into a group? Should there be a group of you who got beaten up by the parents and talk about that and try to understand that rather than the therapist stating, well, if your mother dies before you're 8 years old, you're going to be a depressive. Mm-hmm. That's not to be true.
I think where you're headed, I would very much agree. I believe that we have to have rules for social cohesion. And the reason is that nothing, as you're saying, you know, really predicts from our early parenting all of the individual differences. So if everybody, you know, had a comfortable home, parents that hugged them all the time and so on, there's still going to be a lot of variation. And the variation, no matter how it occurs, whether it occurs because of temperament or because of, from the Buddhist perspective, karma would be other lifetimes that have carried through, or whether the variation is there just randomly, it's going to be there. And that means that there has to be something that contains that variation so that there could be social cohesion. And it's as though we've lost track of that particular guideline in the period of time we're in. And I certainly think that that etiquette could be one way of thinking about it. I think that also just recognizing that in Western culture, we have focused a lot on individual self, and perhaps we need a correction. You know, perhaps we need some rules that would correct, that would have in the past been corrected by religion or tradition.
I think it goes back to where we started. For one, Michael, just, you know, I was born in Brooklyn and I grew up in New York. This, you know, the what I've observed here is just the utter disregard for law and the inability to imagine the consequences for my behavior when I have no regard for law, that others' lives are somehow less valuable. And so one of the epidemics here, I don't know if this is national, but I assume it is just the way people are driving. Like in the city of St. Louis is here, quite literally, entirely lawless. They don't even have enough police to enforce street racing in the middle of the street, where people will literally shut down a city street and drag race. 50 people will call the police. They don't even come. Or people running red lights, which to me is this. Oh, it's an ass. I can interpret it as an aspect of narcissism. What matters is me. I'm not even in my body in the moment enough to even imagine what the consequences are, not just for myself, but for other people. And so I don't know how much of this relates to, you brought up the change in the way culturally we raise children. Part of that changed in the 50s with Dr. Spock and how we raise children. And now even more so, to the point where every child is perfect and good. And, you know, there are no consequences, I guess, in one sense, which again has to do with knowing what the rules are and then having them enforced. And so we're reaping the consequences of an age where we've torn down the value of those rules and social cohesion to vaunt what I want above what the collective, or the connection between the individual and the collective. I guess that's my one little piece to add in here, and that's directly related to that social learning about etiquette.
Well, I think we agree on certain things. I think the blaming Spock is an interesting take on it, because if actually you read Spock, if someone read Spock, you would know that he advised letting the baby cry it out. And he had long passages about the first day, they'll cry for 15 minutes, until they're hoarse. And by the end of the week, they'll stop crying because nobody comes to get them. And so on. So Spock was not as angelic as it was made out to be. And we need, and unfortunately, Spock is also picked on for starting the war or the Vietnam War. And it gets political. And so that would be my only objection. But what you say, in fact, the meat of it is yes, there are no rules. And it doesn't have to be St. Louis in New York City. You can't drive any longer because nobody has any rules. There are no rules. You ask them if you go into a traffic circle, who has the right of way to come in and go out? Nobody knows. It's not that they're violating rules. They don't know there are rules.
And that's the significant difference, right? That makes up a culture and a collective. We have the shared understanding and meaning, and we know what the rules are. And when nobody knows what the rules are, everybody's making it up as they go along, and you get chaos.
Exactly.
I want to do a kind of wrap up first to thank you, Michael Lewis. It was great talking to you. We'll definitely come back with some ideas for etiquette down the line. Mike and I will talk. We'll come back and propose them to you, and we'll see if we can work out some rules for social cohesion that are very basic that might have to do with how do you accept a gift? How do you reply to somebody having made a meal for you? I mean, there's some very basic things. We might be able to talk, the three of us. How do you put the self into a group situation in which there is a recognition that the self depends on the group?
I just had this experience in the group that I created here, which is a psychedelic group where we had to create a code of ethics for everyone in the group. So there's a shared understanding about what we are doing. And so it's been interesting because to hear the resistance from some people, especially some of them who teach in academia, were actually saying, oh, you don't need to do that. But I found it was essential in order to have cohesion, as everybody has a shared playlist and a shared code of ethics where we have an understanding when we get together that this is a space where rules do apply.
Well, maybe you could bring your book from your psychedelic group and the three of us could talk about how we look at that. But it has been really a lot of fun talking with you, Michael Lewis and Michael Berger. I just want to thank you again for your work. I draw on it all the time. You have an extraordinary ability to talk about the development of the self-referential self, that is, our self-awareness and our ability to know what we know and what we don't know, and about how other people see us so that we can see ourselves, know us so we can know ourselves. It's been extremely helpful for me over a long period of time. And I was just happy today we had a chance to visit about that. We'll get back to you after you turn 88 and celebrate an etiquette time with you where we'll work a little bit on the rules for the self. So that would be fun. I hope you will come back and do that with us.
For sure. I think it was a pleasure for me to meet and talk with you again, Polly, and Mike for the first time. I think interesting in our conversation, we've come to a kind of understanding which people who talk about social behavior and people who talk about self need to connect. And I think our connection in this is very important and certainly a start for further dialogue.
Thank you so much.
It's really a pleasure, Michael. Thank you very much.
It
Thank you
was a
very, very
pleasure meeting
much.
you, too. Even about St. Louis.
The home of the hamburger. Enjoyed this episode of Waking Up Is Not Enough, Flourishing in the Human Space? Please consider supporting Waking Up Is Not Enough by contributing to our GoFundMe campaign. You can find the campaign linked in the description. Don't forget to hit like, subscribe, and tap the notification bell so you never miss an episode of insightful discussions and explorations into the human psyche. Waking Up Is Not Enough was edited and produced by Chris Coltrane.